Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Jessen, Judge Brian, the Honorable Judge Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, March 8th, 2022, and we have five cases on the calendar today, three of which are scheduled for oral argument. This morning, we are holding our hearings via Zoom.gov. So please let me start with a few initial matters regarding our virtual format. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of the arguments are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals page at the Judicial Branch's website. Also note that our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of an oral argument unless they have received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance, and they have agreed to comply with the specific conditions established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. With that, Marshall, please call the case before us this morning.
The first case this morning is A211227, Brian Mickelson versus Tracy Area Public Schools.
Counsel, as you probably know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock in one square on your screen. You should see it in the upper left-hand corner. It will reset according to the time you have for your argument. I ask that each counsel please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument so that the recording is clear. Please mute yourself, leave your video on when you're not speaking. And if you have any difficulty with the technology at any point, please let me know and we will stop and we will try to help because we do want to hear from everyone. Counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Deborah Korhouse, D-E-B-R-A-C-O-R-H-O-U-S-E, from Education Minnesota, representing relator Mr. Brian Mickelson in this matter. And Mr. Mickelson is here with me today online. As the court knows from the briefing, this case involves a longtime teacher in the Tracy Public Schools, and that's Mr. Mickelson. Last summer, Mr. Mickelson received an opportunity to explore another career as a union advocate. Minnesota law provides for two different mechanisms for Mr. Mickelson to take a leave of absence from his teaching position rather than resigning. This is important because he needs to be on a leave in order to continue to contribute to his pension. If he is denied a leave of absence, he is denied the right to contribute to this pension, which then is a financial hardship. The school district is not required to make any contributions. The only request to them is to permit the leave. And the extended leave is limited to 3 to 5 years, and the union leave is unlimited in length. Because these leaves are both based in statute, this court applies a de novo standard of review. Relator asserts that the leaves were denied under an erroneous theory of law and without substantial evidence from the record and should therefore be overturned. So, Your Honors, let's start with the union leave. As you know, PELRA requires that public employers allow for union leave for employees to conduct union business. This mandatory leave applies in situations like the current one, where the leave is requested by the employee who has been appointed by, in this case, his exclusive rep as its official, his exclusive representative as its official. The statute does not give the employer discretion in this regard. Respondent, as you know, has raised this court's decision in Blumhart from 10 years ago. But this record here is distinguishable in a critical way from Blumhart. We've heard that court's guidance and have followed it. And this is the first time in those 10 years that we've had to come back to the court for assistance with an employer who has refused to grant the mandatory leave. In the Blumhart case, Ms. Blumhart was not appointed by her exclusive rep, which in that case was the International Falls Union, nor was she assigned as their official. And this court therefore held that the local unit must be the entity that appoints the official, not the state organization or Education Minnesota. And we have met that requirement in this instant matter. The undisputed evidence in the limited record before the court shows that the Tracy Education Association did appoint Mr. Mickelson, and he is also assigned as their official. The requirement
so, Ms. Courthouse, if I may, please. But do we need to even... I question whether we even need to reach that issue. I think the district talks about it as timeliness. I think I look at it in a little, my question is in a little different frame, but just looking at subdivision 6 of the statute, public employer must afford reasonable time off. Isn't it implicit in the statute that that means to current employees, not just to anyone who asks, which I think is another way of perhaps of framing the timeliness issue raised by a respondent here. I mean, could you just, looking at that statute, tell me why we shouldn't read that to apply to current employees? Because when he asked, he was already working for the union, right?
He was, Your Honor. Well, yes, he was, Your Honor. He started in the summer when he was not expected to have any duties for the summer. And he made that request on the day that school was to start. So they were simultaneous. But as you know, Your Honor.
Didn't he start his job a month before he asked for the leave with the union, a month before he asked for the leave? I just want to make sure I'm factually correct.
That is factually correct. I was just adding to that there were no duties required by the school in August. So by the first time that he would have been responsible for both jobs would have been September 1st, which was the date he made the request for the union leave.
Is there anything in the record that tells us when on September 1st the letter was submitted?
There is nothing in the record that says that, Your Honor. That's the trouble with these certiorari appeals. We have limited documentation to work with.
So back to my kind of looking at the statute, kind of with this factual background in mind, I mean, so is it reasonable to read the statute, a public employer must afford reasonable time off? Is reasonable to infer that means to current employees? So the question was, is he still an employee? Is that your reading of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. So if I can make sure I'm answering your question correctly. So I would say that the only reason why there's any question about whether or not he was still an employee is because the district violated the law when it refused to grant his extended leave request, right, which was made back in July before he ever even started working for Education Minnesota. He made a valid request and the district unlawfully denied that request. So we
have to address that issue to get to the right to time off under 179A07?
I think they're certainly intertwined. I think the fact that even if you denied his right to the extended leave, you could still find that he was entitled to the union leave because those requests were made, that request was made when he had not actually been separated from the school district.
Ms. Korhouse, you could help me out a little bit. I'm not sure I understand how they're so intertwined. If the first request is denied, he's an employee, right? He's still an employee. He didn't, the request was to take a leave. And if you deny that request, then he would still be employed unless they then went on to accept the resignation in some formal way. So I don't know that I see how they're so intertwined. Maybe I'm missing something.
I think you're absolutely right, Your Honor. You can get there that same way as well, which is probably the cleanest path, that the only way to separate the employee from the employer is to go through the due process procedures in the Continuing Contract Act, which the district did not do. The district knew full well that he did not want to resign. He withdrew any request to resign. He challenged the denial of the leaves. And so there was no resignation on the table, and they did not act to terminate him for cause, which was their right under the statute. So yes, Your Honor, he remained an employee, and therefore would be under that analysis would also be eligible for.
Well, I guess I was saying, I'm not sure that line, I can follow that line as far as you take it, right? Because it seemed to me that if he was an employee, because they denied the request of, the first request in July, he was an employee until he didn't show up on the first. And at that point, I think you run into a problem with what Judge Jessen was pointing out about the way that statute applies to current employees. It's not that he was no longer an employee because he had resigned, but because he didn't show up to work and had been employed elsewhere for a month. So I wonder about how you can connect that, convince me to take that line as far as you take it when It seems like as of the 1st of September, he was expected to report to work and didn't, and had been employed elsewhere for a month.
Your Honor, so what I would say to that line of questioning is that the Continuing Contract Act has explicit bases for an employer to terminate an employee, and failure to show up is a ground to support termination, right? But it isn't automatic. So what that does is it gives the employer a reason to say, we propose to discharge you because you aren't here. And then that triggers a set of due process rights, which the employer didn't do in September and still has not done, right? They purported to accept a resignation that wasn't proffered. So that's how we get to the line of analysis that he's still an employee because they haven't acted to terminate that relationship. Would also say
and I'm wondering, maybe Judge Jessen, you want to jump in since it kind of following up on your questions, but I was going to ask about the alternative way of framing this timeliness issue, which is it seems that Mr. Mickelson asked to kind of backdate, if you will, right? Asked after the fact for leave to do something he was already doing and had been doing for a month. And so if you look at the timeliness from that side, I'm wondering what authority you have. But before we get there, I don't want to change if Judge Jessen or Judge Wheelock has another question based on the status of him as an employed person under the statute.
Would you like me to go ahead? Okay. So on the timeliness issue, I guess I would, again, have two answers for that. I don't think it's necessary to backdate it because he didn't have any responsibilities to the Tracy Public Schools when he started in August. His first obligation to them was in September. So the district is sort of suggesting that somehow the minute he showed up for another job, he's automatically resigned, which is not consistent with the law nor with the facts. But I would also say that this is where that intertwining piece comes in. He had a valid request for a leave that the district did not honor and was required to under the statute. So for the district to violate a statute and use its violation of that statute to justify its denial of a second statute is unfair. So really what they're saying is, we're not going to offer you the extended leave that we're required to, or I should say that differently. We're not required to offer it, but if we don't, we have to give you reasonable justification, which they failed to do. And so they didn't do that. And then they're using their failure to do that to say it was okay to deny the union leave. Had they honored the request in the first place, it would have been clear that he was an employee and he wouldn't have needed to make the secondary request because he would have already been under a leave of absence that then, as you know, would tie to the pension contributions. So just if I could take a minute to talk about the request for extended leave. We'll note that under the law, it's the school board that is to act on that leave. And in this case, the school board failed to do so. It did not take any action in July, and the superintendent sent a letter purporting to act on their behalf, but didn't have the authority to do that. And most importantly, did not fulfill the statutory obligation to provide reasonable justification for that denial.
I must say, Ms. Cross, I was concerned about the fact that it does appear that if it's the board describing its decision, that appeared, what, in the September minutes? Was its reasonable justification? But looking at your brief, it was not clear to me that you were arguing here, or maybe, you know, to the school board, that wasn't a timely, reasonable justification. Is there any case law or guidance of like when that you can give us about when the school board needs to provide that reasonable justification? Did they, for example, see your argument that when there wasn't a motion made, as I understand it, in July, there wasn't a motion, that then there needed to be a reason on the record about why there wasn't a motion made? I'm just trying to understand the timing of this justification.
Yes, Your Honor, you've said it exactly right. So what the statute says in Subdivision 2 is that the board may grant the leave, right? And then the final sentence of that subdivision says, if the school board denies, which is essentially the same as failing to grant, right, they must provide reasonable justification for that denial. And that did not happen here. So Relator was forced to renew his application to trigger some board action. And when he did that, and when they finally took that up in September, when they denied both the union leave and this leave, they cited the same justification that didn't apply and therefore is unreasonable and doesn't meet the statutory. So in essence, Your Honor, they failed in two regards. One is they didn't provide it at the time the superintendent claims they made a decision, which again wasn't on the record, or it wasn't an actual board action. And then when they actually did take board action that was required under the statute, their justification cited was unreasonable at that time.
I can follow up. Go ahead, Judge Wheelock. Sorry.
That's okay. We might be thinking the same thing. So, Ms. Korhaus, as I read it, it's May deny. You're saying that there was no act by the school board. They had the information. As I looked at the minutes and Superintendent Anderson's report from that meeting, he addressed the request for the leave, and that the board knew that there was that opportunity to make a motion to approve it. There was a note in here about how folks are looking for more long-term positions and that they want to find the best applicants to stay. So I'm seeing something in there that seems to show what their reasoning was. And in addition to that, I'm wondering if the fact that they chose not to make a motion to approve is sufficient to show that, in fact, they did take action on it.
Your Honor, I would say that it's insufficient because those reasons cited by the superintendent do not appear in the board minutes. So we don't know what the board actually considered. That's the superintendent's opinion. We don't know what the board did or did not consider, or there was no vote. There was no, you know, formal board action. I see my time is running out. Did you want me to finish?
You can finish, and then I'd like to allow Judge Bryan to ask his question.
Okay, Your Honor. I just briefly, I do think that they did not act on the record, and the superintendent's recitation is insufficient for that. But even if you do consider what the superintendent recited as justification, that is not reasonable justification because it isn't specific to Mr. Mickelson. It's just a general statement that we have difficulty finding employees in a smaller school district, which, as I've briefed, is insufficient. But I don't want to extend my time too much. Did you want to have a follow-up, Judge Bryan?
Thank you. I maybe you can just address this when you come back, but I'm wondering if you can direct us to where in your brief you make the argument regarding the lack of a motion as an insufficient reason. I see where you address the reasoning in Superintendent Anderson's statement to the board and in the letter after the fact about how difficult it might be, that specialized knowledge that he might have about the difficulty. But I don't see in the brief where you specifically argue that the motion failing for lack of a motion, that there's some insufficient basis on that point. So I don't, maybe you can point to that when you come back on rebuttal.
Okay, Your Honor, thank you.
And counsel for respondent, we now turn to you. The clock is reset. Please begin when you are ready.
It pleases the court, Joseph Lango, Ratledge, Rozak, Maloney, on behalf of the school district. I'm going to start where you just left off, just for continuity of discussion here, relating to the extended leave request back in July and the school board's response to that request. The school board did obviously take it up in their July school board meeting. The superintendent had it right in the report as indicated as to what the rationale was from his perspective. And then the minutes show that the board chair raised this as a motion to approve the request from Brian Mickelson for a 3-year leave of absence pursuant to 122.846. So it's on the agenda. It's in the record. The superintendent's report is in the record. It's raised as a motion to approve, and not one member of the 7-member board would take it up. It therefore died. Under Robert's rules, if a if a agenda item is raised and there is no support for it to move it forward, the matter dies. That is,
right, but Mr. Langle, it's not just Robert's rules that we're looking at, because we have case law that sets a burden for the district here. And so that's my question, is there some burden that the district has, not just to develop the record or to actually take an action in this formal way under Robert's rules? And if they don't take an action in that way, that there's some problem with that. There is a case law that requires the district to bear a burden here that to me makes it a little bit different than simply, did the motion die or not?
Your Honor, and certainly would it have been preferred to have a specific motion to deny on the table and voted on? Certainly. However, having it, it's not like the whole matter was ignored, that it was on the agenda and nobody talked about it. It was raised, the rationale was brought before the school board, and nobody wanted to take an action on it.
But Mr. Mickelson can't make the motion. So presumably the school board could, in every case, decline to make a motion, and then they would somehow be making decisions through inaction in every case. That seems to be a little bit at odds with the burden. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't consider having an item on the agenda raised and discussed by the school board chair as inaction. What we're really talking about here is the lack of a formal motion to deny. Okay. And what I'm concerned about is form over substance. The substance is that the school district, the school boards, addressed the issue. It was raised to them and they declined to act. That's the substance. The formality is that there could have been or should have been a motion to deny, but that doesn't change the substance. Either way, the school board declined to
right, but the issue, it becomes then timeliness, because if the school board itself in passing the resolution in September characterizes what it did in July as taking an action, then we're moving that date of decision potentially from July to September, and that timeliness argument maybe becomes a problem. So it seems like either you'd be arguing that action or lack of action in July was sufficient, or you're going to accept the way it's characterized in September by the board as taking an action for the reasons provided by Mr. Anderson. But it seems difficult to say both at the same time.
But the action in September was in response to his complaint that there was no formal action. Okay. And that's why it was phrased in September. It's like, we're just affirming what we already did. But here's your formal action. But what we did do in July was legitimate in July. And that's why we did it. And it did make sense. Now, the argument on appeal is, well, in September, it doesn't make any sense anymore. Well, that's not true. That they were able to hire an employee. But keep in mind that he wasn't hired under the threat of losing his job in 1 to 3 years. Okay, so the district did prevented the situation that it wanted to prevent, which is to have a job opening with this big restriction on it. And I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
If I may, because you're diving into the was this reasonable justification, right? Which is what I see mostly in both of your briefs on this issue. And I'm just trying to get at the, was there an argument that it wasn't reasonable because it was 2 months later, as opposed to it wasn't reasonable because, you know, the factual issues that you all are talking about, that you're just talking about here?
Again, the September motion was an attempt to clarify what happened in July, right?
Right.
And in July, it was absolutely reasonable. That's the district. It's a very truthful, a very honest reason as to what that justification is. They have a hard time finding teachers in general. And to put a restriction on it makes it all that much more difficult. And nothing in the law requires that it be specific to Mr. Michelson. There's no such requirement. So I think it's entirely legitimate in July. September was just an affirmance of that. And he characterized his subsequent grievance as a renewal of his grievance, of the formal one. It wasn't a new one. And so all we did in September was, again, articulate the rationale that we had applied back in July. It's the same grievance. You know, you denied my send and leave. I don't agree with it. And the district coming back and say, yeah, we denied it for this reason. It's a legitimate reason. I want to talk for a second about union leaves. And this goes back to the questions about his status. Brian Mickelson quit. Okay. There is nothing in the law that requires some magical document, that requires some sort of formal letter of resignation. That requires, certainly, if a teacher walks off the job to take a job somewhere else, the district is certainly not required to take some sort of statutory action against him. Staff quit all the time. And in this case, he said, I'm going to resign. And then the same day, he sent another letter, said, well, I want an extended leave. To which the superintendent said, okay, you know, good luck in your next career. And again, the context is important here. Throughout this whole process, Mr. Mickelson made no secret of the fact that he was leaving the district.
So, Mr. Lang, if I can turn your attention back to the statutory language under 179A07 subdivision 6, would you agree that implicit in that language is that a public employer must afford reasonable time off, you know, or the leave to current employees? I mean, is that a fair reading of that? So doesn't that then get us to the issue of whether, by looking at the statute or, you know, whether he showed up, we have to determine whether Mr. Mickelson was a current employee as of the time he made this request. Is that a fair approach for us to take?
Absolutely. You cannot ask for a leave from a job that you are no longer at. It doesn't make any sense. And again, going back to the context, Ms. Courthouse talks about the fact, well, his first duty day wasn't until September 1st. Yeah, but he made it clear from July 15 on that he wasn't coming back. We all knew he wasn't coming back. He left and took a job at Education Minnesota. Fine. So you took a job at the union. That's fine. We're not going to fight it. But at the same token, don't act like you haven't been there for a month already. When you request union leave, you work for the union. You know how this works. You could have easily asked for union leave back in July, back in August. You know, you could have, even in August, where there's an argument by the union while he was, you know, still employed by the district because he didn't have any active duty work to do. I disagree with that concept. The idea that you can be working full time somewhere else, telling your employer, I have no intention of coming back. I just want leave to get pension benefits. And then claim, well, I'm still working here. No, you're not. You left. You quit. And we're fine with you quitting. And once you quit and you're no longer employed here and you didn't show up on September 1st to do your job, then you cannot ask for leave because you've already left. You can't take leave from a job that you no longer have. So, he certainly knew how to ask for leave. He did it twice before, first for 1 year and then for 3 years and then grieved it. So there's really no excuse for not asking for union leave in a timely fashion in this case. And he didn't do it until after he's already gone. So yes, the union leave is untimely. And it was properly denied on that basis alone. And as for the substance of union leave, and I don't think we need to get there because of the untimeliness, this idea that, oh, he was appointed by the local and thereby we managed to get around the Blumhardt case. There's nothing in the record of any case he was appointed by the local. Okay. And there isn't. He stated in his September 1st letter to the school district, I've been appointed as a union rep with Education Minnesota and will be representing Tracy Education Association along with many other local unions. That's what field staff does. That's their job. There's nothing in that September 1st letter that says, oh, by the way, here's evidence that the local union also appointed me as their local representative to Education Minnesota or to the district. There's nothing in there. So the district's position is that he fails in union leave in both counts. He fails in a Blumhardt substantively because he doesn't have the right jobs, no evidence that he did. And it was untimely in the first place.
So if I may, Mr. Langel, as I understand the case law reading the briefs, there is no Minnesota statute or case law defining reasonable justification for purposes of this particular statute, the discretionary leave statute. So would you just give me your definition of how you think we ought to define reasonable justification? And also address whether, if it is an issue of first impression, whether we should be issuing a precedential opinion.
Well, as you know, the word reasonable permeates the law. It's that word that the legislature loves to use that throws the burden on the courts to figure it out. So here we are, reasonable justification. What I find interesting about it is what it doesn't say. It doesn't say that this is a quasi-judicial decision. It doesn't say that this is a contested case type of scenario. It doesn't say that you have to have factual findings. It doesn't have any of those elements of the higher sort of contested case type standard in it. All it says is that it's discretionary and that the justification has to be reasonable, which, as I indicated in the brief, means you can't discriminate against him because of his age or whatever. You can't do it out of personal animosity. You can't flip a coin and make it random. That's not reasonable. That's just, you know, whatever. There has to be, and you can't just say nothing. Say, like, well, no, don't like it. Don't want to do it. You have to provide some justification. And reasonable is just simply, it makes sense. It's common sense. It's rational. I mean, you can come up with all sorts of synonyms for it, right? But there's nothing in there that creates this high standard, which is what the union is trying to do here, is to elevate the standard in an attempt to argue, well, the district didn't make it. It's not up there. It's just reasonable justification. And like I said before, this problem that the district has is a very honest and very truthful problem. Rural Minnesota, we've lost a lot of teachers. They're hard to find replacements. The district got lucky in this case, but they're hard to find. And to say that we don't want to handcuff ourselves by making this a temporary job is a perfectly legitimate and, yes, reasonable response to a request for a discretionary leave.
Mr. Langel, do you please answer the last part of Judge Jessen's question, okay, which was whether, if we're defining reasonable justification, it should be a presidential opinion?
I was just
your time is running out. Please take some time to answer.
Yeah, thank you. You're right. There is no case law on this specific statute with respect to this standard. On the other hand, there is a lot of case law as to what constitutes being reasonable. So do I think that a published decision is necessary? Not necessarily, but certainly it may be helpful.
Judge Wheelock, may I ask another question?
Please do.
So under whatever standard we're using for reasonableness in this case, let's assume that Superintendent Anderson had not provided his report, that there's no record evidence that the district itself has this specialized knowledge about how difficult it might be to find a temporary replacement. Absent that, is it still a reasonable justification if they made that decision for that reason, but they didn't have any report or any evidence that there's this knowledge?
If the school board itself came up with that reason, the same reason. Yeah, that's absolutely legitimate, because keep in mind, it's the school board that does all the hiring. They know the difficulties. They get the resignations across their desk, and they are aware of the difficulties right now with respect to hiring and retaining employees.
So it's not a pure objective reasonableness. We're assuming some things about the subjective knowledge of the school board regarding hiring practices and their experience.
Well, certainly the school board, school board is certainly familiar with the hiring difficulties, because like I said, they're the ones that actually have to do it. And the report by the superintendent is just, indicating his own view on that based upon, because obviously he does the legwork. I think that all of that is entirely appropriate under the statutory language.
Thank you, Mr. Langle. We'll turn to counsel for appellant for the final word. You have 5 minutes. Please begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will start with Judge Bryan's question that we left with in the beginning. I would point to page 8 in my reply brief, Your Honor, and it's not directly the same as the question you were asking about the statute, but I do reference the fact that respondent, and this is in the first partial paragraph, the last sentence, where I say, by its own choice, respondent waited to act to issue a denial until after it had successfully found a replacement. It cannot now claim it had reasonable justification for that denial when its earlier claims had been disproved. So,
anything in the initial brief?
Not that I found, Your Honor. I guess I stopped there. I think it is consistent with the argument that the school board didn't act, and because it didn't act, it didn't provide any reasonable justification, which I would also point out to the court's line of questioning with Mr. Langle. I don't think you actually have to establish a standard here, because the fact is, whatever the standard is, the board didn't meet it. But they didn't, in July, they didn't say anything on the record, right? And in September, what they did say wasn't true. So I think you can reach a decision here without establishing a standard. Now, of course, we like standards and that's helpful to us, but I don't think you need to do that here, because I would also point out to Mr. Langle's point about this not being quasi-judicial, that the actions that the board takes are quasi-judicial, and our ability to appeal those decisions are directly to this court under writ of certiorari. And in reviewing those decisions, this court looks to see if there was an abuse of discretion under a substantial evidence standard. It's not just any evidence provided some arbitration decisions where the arbitrator said, in exactly the same kind of factual situation here, where the school district didn't do any investigation on the specific position and just relied on the fact that it's generally hard to find employees, the arbitrator held that that wasn't any evidence, much less substantial evidence. So I don't think that a general statement made 2 months later is sufficient. I would also say to Mr. Langle's point about the specialized knowledge line of questioning, we have a limited record here, but our relator was there for 29 years. So they hadn't attempted to replace him, at least for 29 years. So there was no evidence that they attempted to, or that they considered at all the fact that he was specifically teaching physical education, or that they didn't even ask whether he was intending to come back, whether they could talk to a candidate about the fact that he's requesting the leave for pension purposes. I'm not quite sure why Mr. Langle is saying that they, and again, this isn't in the record, but that they were able to assure his replacement that he didn't have a limited job, because at the district knew we were challenging this, its decision, both in the arbitration or setting and here. So that if they provided that assurance, that's kind of striking to me that they would do that. I would also note for the court that when the reason why I know the timing is a big consideration here. And I would just say that the reason why the request was made later is that the first request was enacted on, in a sense, for all practical purposes, was denied. So Mr. Mickelson challenged that, his union challenged that on his behalf. And then he said, well, what about this other leave that is a mandatory leave? It's not like he was sitting around and not addressing this. He had applied for a right and the district didn't follow through on its obligation under the statute. So he gave them another way to look at this. But the reason, to the extent there is any confusion about whether or not he was employed, that's only an issue because the board didn't follow its responsibility under the extended leave statute, which requires, pardon me, Judge Justin, go ahead.
I know time is running short, but I was struggling with he didn't get the initial leave. And so he challenged that, I think you're saying, through kind of the arbitration process, right? Mm-hmm. But then why should we be looking at it here? Isn't that for the arbitrator to decide?
Thank you, Your Honor, for that question. In fact, I know this isn't in the record, but counsel just last night filed a request for dismissal in that arbitration case. So they are not agreeing that it be heard in arbitration. So it's very incredibly important for us that this court hear this case because the district is refusing to let it be heard or doing everything it can to keep an arbitrator from hearing it. I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any other questions, Judge Jessen, Judge Bryan? Okay. The court will take this matter under advisement.